It was lock and low, rock and roll, 300 miles on a Baghdad road. Point and shoot and duck and dive, not your magic carpet ride. M to the captain, boys and me, rounds coming in from the feta in. Shapes that move, a muffled shout, the captain yells, now take him out. Drop the bomb, clap your hands, pull the trigger on the man. Lock and load, rock and roll, 300 miles on a Baghdad road. Rat tat tat and something fell, then the 762 gave him hell. Cloud of dust, dirty flash, then the others made a dash. Two in white, is that a gun? One in black, they're on the run, waving something I can't see. Looks like enemy to me. Drop the bomb, clap your hands, pull the trigger on the man. Lock and load, rock and roll, 300 miles on a Baghdad road. Draw a bead, I'm on the mark, 16 and cough and bark. Shapes go a tumbling round as the bullets fly and cut them down. Dust up clears, it looks secure. We going slow to make sure. Weapons ready if they make a move. Allie can play a trick or two. Drop the bomb, clap your hands, pull the trigger on the man. Lock and load, rock and roll, 300 miles on a Baghdad road. Some things that you shouldn't see, not in this life, take it from me. Some things can't be undone when the safety's off the gun. Couple of boys like a my kid brother, long black robes of a mother. Blood drains into the sand, not a weapon near their hands. Drop the bomb, clap your hands, pull the trigger on the man. Lock and load, rock and roll, 300 miles on a Baghdad road. Now that I came back stateside, I can still see those stone cold eyes. Twisted bodies in a trance, the sun, the sand, the flies that dance. Keep your medals and your speeches, only one victor's in my reach. I drain the bottle and the faces fade as I leave this dark parade. Drop the bombs, clap your hands, pull the trigger on the man. Lock and load, rock and roll, 300 miles on a Baghdad road.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to the debate, was Bush 43 the worst president of the last 50 years? You can hear this program at 96.5 in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterview.blogspot.com.
Simon Jenkins.
What I think is extraordinary to people abroad is that those of us who are enthusiasts for America and American liberties cannot see why you needed to do these things. You will never persuade the outside world that you have not restricted liberty in America. You will never persuade them that you have not taken out Muslims as a particular group. And you will never persuade them that you really needed to do these things.
What have we done to Muslims in America?
What
has happened?
Arrested them.
We've arrested Muslims in America.
And incarcerated them without trial.
We've incarcerated Muslims in America without trial? Name one instance.
But the lobbyists belabor me all day with lists of people who have vanished.
You know, this is on the border of lunacy, with all due respect.
But you didn't need to do it. You've got the world believing America's a less robust place than it really is.
Now, what part of the world is that? Is that China and India? Do they have... I'm serious. Let's talk about the world. The world turns out to be a certain class of liberal elites in Western Europe. Not all of Western Europe. It does. Is America unpopular? Has anyone here been... Is America unpopular in East Asia? Is America unpopular? Is Bush's policy towards China been terrible in terms of the Chinese views? India is a great success story, a rather important, huge democracy for Bush. Even in Western Europe, when Bush took over, there were rather anti-American prime ministers, democratically elected, obviously, in France and in Germany, or at least skeptical of America. Then Merkel wins in Germany, and Sarkozy wins in France. If America's image is so ruined, if they just can't stand America, why did they elect the more pro-American candidate in both of those races?
I want to go to questions. First row, and... you know, I don't want to be biased against folks in the back just because I can't see them. If you can be a little horizontal, all the way in the rear, blue shirt. I want to collect your question in the front row, and then you'll be second there.
I hate to disrupt that exchange, but question for Mr. Rove and Mr. Crystal. Who is the worst president of the last 50 years and why?
The statement has been made that we have been made safer since because of President Bush's administration since September 11th. If he is to receive credit, is he to receive blame for not protecting us for September 11th?
Okay, I want to take a third one from about eight rows up and three seats over.
Question for Messrs. Crystal and Rove. In the last 50 years, this administration has been by far the biggest spending administration, with the possible exception of Lyndon Johnson.
Can we ask you to start the question again?
In the last 50 years, this administration has been by far the biggest spending administration, with the possible exception of Lyndon Johnson, and that's even before spending on Homeland Security and Iraq. What is your response to that?
Okay. I want to go to the second question first. On the question of September 11th, does President Bush deserve any blame for September 11th?
We published in the Weekly Standard in July of 2001 an article by Reuel Marcoret, who I think has participated in these debates, alarmed that we were not doing enough to fight al-Qaeda, that they had bombed the USS Cole in October of 2000, and that neither the Bush administration nor the Congress, Democrats, Republicans, were really understood how serious the threat of al-Qaeda is. I think the Bush administration would say, I mean, I think Condi Rice and others have said this, that they now wish, of course, they had been more alarmed and more alert as they had taken office in those first few months. So yes, there's blame to go around on 9/11. But fundamentally, the growth of al-Qaeda, the ability of al-Qaeda, which was key to have the terror training camps unmolested in Afghanistan, is not something that primarily happened under Bush.
But if we just one more word on this, because if you read Richard Clark's book or some of the other inside accounts of this, it's clear it's not that nobody had heard of al-Qaeda. Richard Clark, for example, was running around with his hair on fire about how dangerous this threat was. And it's clear that Bush in the early days downplayed it, rejected it, didn't take it seriously, and did so because it had been a particular focus of the Clinton administration, and he was reversing policy.
If it was such a focus of the Clinton administration, it would be nice to know exactly what they did about it, since...
They missed. Bush hasn't got him either. They started a little later, anyway.
A questioner asked, who is the worst president of the last 50 years?
Look, I mean, this is why this question is a little artificial. I mean, Lyndon Johnson probably made the worst mistake, perhaps, of the last 50 years with Vietnam, but he also deserves a huge amount of credit, I think, and I'll say this as a conservative and Republican, for some of what he did in terms of certainly civil rights, and I would say something like Medicare. So people are not, you know, univocally good or bad. I do think, I'd say in terms of personal corruption of the political system for political, of the judicial system and of the governmental system for political ends, clearly Nixon. And I would say in terms of just incompetence and leaving the country in a dangerous shape, which had to be reversed, Carter. So the 70s was a bad decade, in my opinion, for American presidents and for America and for the world, which was reversed by Reagan.
Carl Rove, we had a questioner say that President Bush was a big spender.
Yeah. Look, I like how, first of all, you did put aside Homeland Security. Let's take a look at discretionary domestic spending. The last budget left to us, the FY01 budget, left to us by that previous president, whose name you can fill in, increased discretionary domestic spending in FY01 15% in 1 year. That means that would double the discretionary spending of the federal government if left at that rate in about 5.5 years. We cut in our first budget, FY02, discretionary domestic spending to 7%, in FY03 to 4%, in FY05, 2%, and 6, 7, and 8 have flatlined discretionary domestic spending of the government. It's been hard to do. We're going to leave an enormous benefit in place for Barack Obama in that we have flatlined discretionary domestic spending.
And the biggest spending item are two things, the tax cuts. We can debate economic policy, but I think an awful lot of people think, especially the 2003 tax cuts, were sensible and ended up producing actually a lot of revenue, and the prescription drug benefit, which I would defend as a conservative. Medicare exists. It is a pretty good program. It had to be improved. It had to be updated by bringing prescription drugs into it. It's come in under budget, and I think 92% of seniors are covered, and it seems to be working pretty well. Now, if you're a strict, small government libertarian conservative, you would object to Bush starting a new entitlement program, and that's a defensible philosophical position. But in that case, the biggest domestic expenditure, the biggest piece of domestic legislation of the Bush administration, it did what Bush said it was going to do.
If I'm collecting questions again from the upper left where the camera is.
John, could I add a little bit of that?
I want to move on, Carl, because your colleague covered it quite well. Yes, sir.
Hello. My question is for Mr. Jenkins.
I think your mic might have cut out. At least it did to the hall here. Can you try again?
Sir Jenkins, before 9/11, terrorism was viewed as a criminal act. Let's investigate. Let's get the bad guys. In my opinion...
Sir, I apologize because we've got the camera with you and the mic is malfunctioning and another one is on its way to you. While that's happening, I'm going to go to a question down front row, center.
The question is for Mr. Rove. Had the intelligence been accurate prior to the invasion of Iraq, would the invasion have still taken place in your view?
No. In the aftermath of 9/11, the concern was about a tyrant guilty of enormous human rights abuses, but possessed with weapons of mass destruction and an intention to use them as a state sponsor of terror. Absent that, I suspect the administration's course would have been to work to find more creative ways to constrain him than he had been constrained in the 90s. The president did have an enormous concern about the human rights abuses under Saddam Hussein. He also had a concern about the deterioration of the credibility of the United Nations, which had passed 16 resolutions calling upon him to abide by the outcome and the agreements that he made in the aftermath of the 91, of the first Gulf War, that he had not lived up to. But absent weapons of mass destruction, no, I don't think there would have been an invasion.
Okay, are we set for the question up on the corner up here yet? And otherwise, I'll come up the aisle. If you can come up the aisle, red sweater.
My question is for Mr. Rove. What is the future of the party, more specifically in terms of diversifying the party? As we've seen, that was the biggest issue next to the economy. Can you please talk on that issue?
Okay, let's hold that question and collect a couple more just because we're having this microphone problem. The young lady of two rows down, eyeglasses.
This is for Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Weisberg. You've criticized President Bush for going to war with Iraq. If President Bush had not decided to go to war with Iraq and had only decided to go to war with Afghanistan to fight terrorism, do you think Saddam Hussein would have, A, remained a neutral and impartial observer in the war between Islamic terrorists in the West, B, allied with the United States in an effort to stamp out Islamic terrorists and bring democracy to Afghanistan, or C, grown a dangerous supporter and protector of Islamic terrorists, including al-Qaeda and others?
Simon and Jacob, why don't you take that?
We have a problem here. I just don't see terrorism as a state-projected force in the way that you do. I regard it in the sense that the question I was trying to ask before, as a criminal act of gangsters roaming the world and badly in need of curtailing by their own governments. I think the way we treated international terrorism is to glorify it, to give it the status of a state. We've given huge recruiting energy to those people who want to bring young people into this particular odious fold. And I think by declaring war on some governments, I may say not all governments that harbour them, we've accorded them a status wholly beyond what they deserve. I believe that my country and your country has overstated this threat. I just think we've overdone it. And in overdoing it, we turned very large numbers of countries, particularly in the Islamic world, into state menaces. They themselves are undermined by the states we've given to these people, Pakistan being a classic case of that. This is quite a cosmic question. If you declare a very small group of people to be an international menace, you turn them into a sort of hero, and we've done that, and it's been a terrible, terrible mistake.
Jacob. Mr. Rove mentioned somewhere in that incredible litany of distortions that that I was in favor of getting rid of Saddam Hussein. I was, as were a lot of sensible people. I didn't happen to favor doing it the way Bush did, largely unilaterally, rejecting allies as opposed to building pressure on Saddam and not waiting for the inspection process to play out. But I think the point is, and what we've subsequently learned, and the problem I had that Bush didn't have was I did not have access to analysts from the Department of Energy trying to tell everybody that those aluminum tubes were not for nuclear weapons. But the point is that Saddam was being had been successfully disarmed and was being successfully contained. And he was not supporting international terrorism because he was afraid to. He was a miscalculator, a serial miscalculator, but he was not a madman. And I think he understood very clearly that supporting terrorism against the United States would have resulted in the same thing that happened anyway, his destruction. I think what would have happened if we didn't invade Iran? I'd actually like to turn the question around a little bit and ask Bill Kristol, for example, does he, knowing what we know now, still think invading Iraq would make sense? But I think that we might have ended up having to take military action against Saddam Hussein at some point in the future, but I think we could have done it with allies. I think we could have done it in a more thought-out way, and I think we could have planned for an occupation. It could have been expected if we knew we were going to have to do it.
Bill, I think that question to you was more than rhetorical, but I want you to take 20 seconds to answer it.
I think Carl is right that the president would not, in fact, have gone to war if he had known what seems to have been the case, that Saddam had no real functioning weapons of mass destruction programs at the time. Having said that, I think as an analytical matter, Carl's certainly right. The American political system wouldn't have supported it. No, I think it was right to go to war to remove Saddam. I think the Middle East would be incredibly much more dangerous if he or his sons were in power. I think every radical state and every radical group would be empowered because weakness is what empowers them, and he would have stood down and affect the U.S., and the UN and the civilized world. It's inconceivable we could have kept the sanctions up. They were already fraying. It's inconceivable. The inspectors were only in because we moved 150,000 troops next door. They would have gone out. It would have been a horrible defeat for the West, and I think we would have had a much more resurgent radicalism in the Islamic world than we have today, where I think it's a mixed bag, but actually in many respects the terror groups are on the defensive and on the run.
Karl Rove, you had a question, Karl Rove, about the future of the party, particularly in its ability to be more diverse.
Well, after a loss, every political party goes through a period of introspection and rebuilding, and the Republicans have to do that this time. Let's be clear, though, about what happened in this election, and that is that Barack Obama got 3.1% more than Al Gore got in 2000. This was not the blowout that you might expect given the conditions of the economy and the unpopularity of the war. This was not a 60-40 victory. He got 53% of the vote. He got 7.1 million more votes than John Kerry got, and four out of every five were black or brown. And therein lies the challenge for the Republican Party. The party of Lincoln needs to make a concerted appeal for African-American votes, knowing that in the short term it is going to pay off not one twit. And in the long run, it has a moral obligation as a great political party to represent all Americans. And it can only do that by making the case to African Americans and Latinos. And the Republicans have a similar problem brewing among Latinos. George Bush got 44% of the vote among Latinos. John McCain, who was a courageous early advocate of immigration reform, got 31. We cannot take the largest, fastest growing minority in America and write it off like we did with African Americans. And then we also have a problem with young, because let's be candid. The war has turned young voters, 18 to 29, against the war. They voted for Obama by 2-1, and they not only were against the war, they were against the Republicans. And those three, the Republicans have got to work on. But on the other hand, the Republicans had a victory, had a defeat this year that was not the blowout, and it was also the victory for Obama that was not as big as anticipated. Take, for example, Ronald Reagan in 1980. When he got elected, he brought in 100 state senators with him, net, and 300 members of state houses. This time around, Barack Obama brought in a net of 10 state senators and 94 House members. This was an individual victory for a charismatic, articulate, inspiring individual, an historical figure, and the Democrats are going to make a mistake if they think this is some kind of gigantic swing to their party.
We're heading down the home stretch on questions from the audience. Where the mic is positioned now in the camera, and halfway up to the left, the red sleeve. I'm sorry, because I'm rather blinded by the lights. I'm seeing the colors of sleeves. I'll take you over there first.
Okay, as I tried to say before, my question is for Mr. Jenkins or Weisberg. Some will say that George W. Bush's most difficult decision, and maybe most courageous, is to treat terror as war and not a criminal act. I ask you, we've had decades to judge these. Please name me the difficult and courageous decisions made by Lyndon Baines Johnson and Jimmy Carter that have been proven to be the right ones, please.
All right, and up here.
Mr. Jenkins, I watched Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday morning, and the UK outlawed anchor babies as a way to curb illegal immigration. Do you think that will work here in America, and what does the panelist think?
I'm gonna pass on that question, I'm afraid, because it's actually not on our topic tonight, with respect, but thank you very much. And I want to ask the cameraman to pivot to his right, and there's a man in a blue shirt.
To Simon and Jacob, how would you describe Bush's prosecution of the Iraq War, his rationale for the Iraq War, versus the rationale and prosecution of the Vietnam War by JFK, LBJ, and Nixon?
All right.
What differences do you see in how those two conflicts have been resolved?
It seems as though those two questions actually come together, so I'm going to go for a third one. The gentleman, whom I can see clearly in the bright light with his hand up.
Just one simple question. First of all, thank you all for coming here. I'm curious if an aspect of the success of the Bush presidency is his foreign policy and his defending us against the terrorism, then how do you explain the fact that no one's caught Osama bin Laden at this point, the chief architect of the act that set all this off?
Karl Rove?
Because he is hiding in a deep, dark cave in a very dark corner of, in all likelihood, Pakistan. And to suggest that not every effort has been made to get him is inaccurate. Every effort has been made to get him, to get at his communications, to get at his allies, to get at his subordinates, to get at his inner circle. A lot of them are dead, and we aren't hearing much from him. But we got to recognize we're dealing with an odd part of the world. This is not, as Simon alluded to, this is not a state. And it operates through states. The Taliban controlled a state, Afghanistan, that harbored and trained and gave succor to these terrorists. But they live in a odd and dark part of the world that is not a state, and it's what makes destroying Al Qaeda's leadership and our relationship with Pakistan both two very problematic things.
Simon and Jacob, you had two questions along the lines of comparisons of George Bush to both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, with I think the implication that the president's Iraq was their Vietnam. Can you take on that question?
I mean, I was a very young journalist, was in Vietnam at the very end of that war, and attended the relevant briefings. And this is not a very well-informed comment, but my view was that the Vietnam War and occupation of South Vietnam was far more competently executed than the occupation of Iraq. The occupation of Iraq was, and I've followed American and British occupation troops around the world for most of my career, the occupation of Iraq was simply the most incompetent thing I've ever seen. It was stupefyingly incompetent. And I've no doubt at all that many people possibly on the platform wouldn't disagree with that, because it was conducted by a very small group of people against the advice of a much larger group of people within the administration. It simply has been a catastrophe. Afghanistan is much better conducted, although I think it's a much more difficult war to fight, and that's why I think it's going to end in greater tears than Iraq will end. Iraq is fairly simple to end. You just leave. It'll be very, very difficult to leave Afghanistan. But certainly in Vietnam, I think you had, on the whole, relatively competent military people there. They had experience of Korea, many of them. They lost, but they only just lost. I do think that America could have stabilized South Vietnam had it stayed longer. It was not the right place to be and the right thing to do, but it was not a hopeless case. I think when you go into a country without a good reason or with the purpose of simply punishing the country, as was the case in both Iraq and Afghanistan, you're not likely to do well, because you haven't really plotted what the purpose of this exercise is. It was simply to punish. And I think it's that punitive element that's been the problem, certainly in Iraq. And I'm sorry, I've been there only twice, but I cannot accept that it is in any sense of the word a success.
Students, please open your test booklets and begin standardized test number 6,422,393.
This is my school life, September until May, caught in a landslide of standardized tests each day. We gotta show that we can compete statewide.
Multiple choice,
because we're tested out. Look at me, I can't spell S-A-T.
Just check off a box, time's running on the clocks.
Brains fried.
Students, I've got a plan. I could sort of bend the rules, and we'd beat the other schools. Students, your time is almost done. But if I change the clock, it's just begun. Ha ha! Ooh! Now our scores will be real high, and I'll be picked as teacher of. Teacher of the Year. I'm gonna give you some little tiny hints.
Question two, it really is frightening. Who on earth would know the father of astronomy?
Galileo!
Galileo, who is that? I didn't know.
No!
I'm just a dumb kid from a dumb family.
She's just a dumb kid from a dumb family. Spare her the shame of a bad SAT. MIT, Harvard Law, will you let me go?
You're joking, no.
We will not let you go.
Let them go. You're joking.
They will not let us go.
Let them go. You're joking.
They will not let us go.
Let them go.
We will not let you go.
Let me go.
We'll not let you go.
We will not go.
No.
Let politicians take these tests.
See what they know.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.